One of the most beautiful little cartoon strips I have seen in a long time is a cartoon strip done by Herb Gardner. It does not appear in New York. And more's the pity. We could use it here. And I'm going to tell you what his New Year's cartoon strip is about. His strip is based on the Nevishes, which you've probably seen in the stores, you know. Next week we've got to get organized and so on, which are a kind of delineation of the secret hopelessness of everybody. The secret thing within every one of us that says any minute now they are going to discover what a miserable phony I really am. You know, a lot of guys spend their whole life accumulating degrees, joining clubs, accumulating and kind of affirming various official honors, because these somehow, these honors, these official things that you hang on your wall, somehow shield you and lull you and make you feel that you really are, in a sense, a superhuman. But underneath it all, there is that little lurking thing that says, even a phony, and any minute now, the world is going to discover what a rotten idiot fat is.
10 o'clock in the morning.
And so, when the guy is 78, he hires 3 ghostwriters to write 4 fantastic, gigantic biographies of himself. I must state my position. And he gets up and he has this Stein.
I'm thinking of.
Around, looks at the assembly there, and they're all looking up at him. And he says, in just a few moments, friends, it will be 1958. And we will have entered a new year. And I want to say that I consider it a privilege and a wonderful delight to have such a great group of friends. And that I am a rich man. As I enter 1958, surrounded by my friends, and somebody says, hey, Irving. Seymour says, Irving, wait a minute, Irving. It's going to be 1960. And Irving stops and looks at all of them. He says, each man marches to the sound of his own drum. So what year are you living in, roughly? I mean, it may be 1960, but where are you? I mean, where really are you? I'm not saying what year do you write on the checks. Where are you really? Each man marches to the beat of his own drum. That's right, Irving. That is absolutemo correctemo. Indeedimo. Excuse it if I break into French, but there are some words that just must be said in another language because you know how it is with the fringe hanging down there. Indeedimo. It must be stated. And so, this is our New Year's program. I mean, we are facing a new year. We are also plunging headlong into a new year. And now, if I may have, my player piano music there. Yes, Roses of Picardy will do very well. Roses of Picardy. This is what they were saying about New Year's, you know, and it never changes. Wait, stop, just a minute, Eddie. Up. You know, well, I have to preface this with a remark here. This friend of mine who was an archaeologist and an anthropologist was doing a lot of digging. He was on a dig in Africa someplace, and they came across the very important clues as to the very beginnings, the origins of mankind and his entire social structure. And they put it together again, and it's a kind of a sad story. There were these two guys sitting on the shore of an ancient antediluvian lake, a terribly old primeval lake that even in those days didn't have any fish in it. And it had been fished out by men who had come before. All lakes are all fished out before you get there. And even then, of course, it was the same thing. Man has always been faced with the same dilemma. And so these two guys are down there on their haunches. And they're scratching once in a while. And one is named Charlie, and the other is named Og. And they're down there, and once in a while, Og goes down and he picks up a clam and knocks it against the rock. And by the way, I would love to have, right now, I'd love to have a plate of cherry stone clams. Do you mind if I digress? I mean, you will give me this little thing on New Year's, won't you? This is the holiday. And I would like to have a plate of cherry stones. I would sit here and I would make myself up a little sauce with the catsup and the lemon and a little Worcestershire sauce and maybe a little cayenne pepper. Oh, well, you know, Oh, gee, Shepard, come on, will you? And so these two guys are sitting there, and they're not going to get... Even then, the man knew what was good for him, and he's eating the clams. You know that they're coming up with a clam popsicle next year? For really hip kids, I mean, for kids who are epicures. I mean, kids are getting tired of those orange and those chocolate popsicles, and there are some kids on the east side that are demanding clam broth popsicles, which I kind of like. Also, green turtle soup popsicles, which is kind of nice. Oh, yes, these are for the hip kids, the swinging kids, with a little touch of tarragon. And maybe just a little oregano, or oregano, if you prefer the downtown... It's actually oregano. I mean, you know, the hip kids are making it here these days, and so they're sitting around, and these two guys, and they're knocking the clams together, and this is a sad story. You want to know how it started. And so Charlie's sitting there. Charlie was, you know, just sitting there. He was picking his teeth and looking out over the lake, and it was a gray, gray day. It was gray all the time in those days. The sun hadn't been discovered yet. And it was very gray. There were no trees or anything. They hadn't discovered wood yet. And so they're sitting there. And Og has just come back, and he's knocked down a couple of clams. And he's looking out. This is the way they put it together. Of course, these are the records. You find this. It's written up in one of the anthropological journals. Very interesting story. And Og turns to Charles, this fateful moment in man's history, and said, you know, it's going to be different next year. Charles looks at him and says, what did you say? He says, it's going to be different next year. So what do you mean next year? What are you talking about? He says, next year. Just next year. It's just something that popped in my mind. It's going to be different next year. And so Charlie didn't say anything to that. He just sort of looked out over the lake, and Og didn't say any more to it either because he had uttered a profundity. And since profundities are not even understood by men, he didn't ripple his brow. For maybe 20 minutes. And then he turned to Charlie and said, Charlie, it is going to be different next year. I feel it somehow inside, in my bones. And Charlie said, look, will you get off my back, Og? What is this year routine? And Og said, you just remember what I said. It's going to be different next year. And it was. In fact, it was different every year ever since. No one had even discovered the term, it will be different. Everyone just thought it was always going to be the same. Just like all giraffes think it's going to be the same from year to year. But man invented the concept of it's going to be different. Hence, he invented the concept of progress, defeat, victory, and final annihilation. All of these are mankind's inventions. Great inventions, by the way. They rank with the wheel and the axle and seven-spotted dice. All the other big things that man has come up with from time to time. It was different. It was different the year after that, the year after that, the year after that, and the year after that, until finally it was even different in 1959. And it will be different in 1960. More or less. But you see, the problems that gnaw at the underbelly of each one of us will remain constant, even though the conditions under which they gnaw change. Mull that over. And now while you're mulling... By the way, when are we going to have a good mull in this neighborhood? We haven't had a mill for a long time. You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to have a mill one day when all of us gather out in front of the theater where they're showing Sweet Bird of Youth, and about 8:40 we start making bird calls. I mean, they couldn't stop it. I mean, bird calls. I'm pretty good. I do the crested warbler pretty good. And I also do this one. How many of you can do this? This is a male trick. Hardly any woman I know can do this. All right, I'll do it again, once more. Now, you see, you fold your hands so, and you go... When I was a kid, I used to sit out in center field. Did you know that I was famous on the radio, even before I'd ever been on the radio? I used to sit out in center field in the bleachers in Comiskey Park, and when there was a quiet lull, when Luke Appling had fouled off 17 straight foul balls, and it was quiet, and it looked like they were running out of balls, and there'd be about 150 people out there, and it was quiet, and the Browns were playing the Sox. It was very quiet. I would go like this. And it would echo throughout the whole park. And Bob Ellison would say, there's that idiot making that noise again out in center field. I used to tell all the kids at school, I'm the idiot out in center field. And it has remained true to this day. I am still the idiot in center field. I want to get down to the dugout with all the big guys like Steve Allen and Ed Sullivan and all the rest of them. I'm just sitting in the... Oh, well, it's another story. It's another problem. I got a bad agent. Also, I have a bad mind, which definitely... I am not a true believer, you know. That gets in my way all the time. Now, please, piano music. Now, hold it there now. I will now give you an archaeological lesson. And this is the archaeological... Well, let's say it's social archaeology. Digging among the remnants of the past. What other guys have thought about the passage of time before you, you know. The problems have always remained the same. And there are some guys who recognize the fact that it is not a clean slate at all that you're stepping into when you step into the next year. You step into a very crowded slate. And that slate has got all kinds of marks all over it already. And here's what George Ade said. This is the fable of successful Tobias and some of his happy New Year's. You know, maybe I ought to save this until after 11 o'clock. Or should I read it now? Now? I mean, I somehow feel that the true guys are with us after 11 o'clock. It's a little band, a tiny band. There's about 9 guys, according to the latest rating. Well, there were 12 last month, actually. But they're there because of something, you know. They're there because of a flame. I don't know what it is, but they're there. All right, we will do it now. A fable of successful Tobias and some of his happy New Year's. Once there was a financial heavyweight, the milestones of whose busy life were strung back across the valley of tribulation into the green fields of childhood. Like most of our aristocrats, he got his start out among the cornrows. His youth was spent very happily, but he did not get onto the fact until years later. He used to work 14 hours per for his board and clothes, and his only dissipation was to take in the Swiss bell ringers every season. At the close of each year, he was permitted to attend a watch meeting at the Mount Zion Church. The watch meeting is a form of gaiety invented a long time ago by someone who was not feeling well at the time. The outfit was supposed to sit for 3 or 4 hours on hard benches, meditating on all the low-down, ornery things that they had done during the old year. Some of them had to hurry in order to crowd this line of meditation into a brief 4 hours. Now and then, a local big guy with throat whiskers would arise and talk for a short time on the subject of death and wonder how many of those present would be taken in by the Grim Reaper during the next year. And then, just at midnight, the sexton would toll the bell so as to cheer everyone up. Then each of the merrymakers would go home and eat a piece of mince pie and a bellflower apple and retreat to the feathers, feeling a little ashamed for having stayed up so late. Later on, after Tobias moved into town and began to wear store clothes and stand-up collars and put oil on his hair, he encountered another kind of New Year's Day. The era was that of the open house, which, by the way, parenthetically, still remains with us today in a small degree. All the women received, and the men went over the entire circuit and traded job-printed cards for something to eat and drink. This made it fine for those who were not ordinarily invited into the best homes. The men roamed about in flocks, and usually they had a hard finish, for it was customary in those good old days of democratic simplicity for every true gentleman to take a drink when it was proffered by the hand of a lovely woman. And lovely women seemed to regard it as her assignment to put all of the nice young fellows to the bad. It was customary to mix tea, coffee, sherbet, lemonade, eggnog, artillery punch, fizzerine, and straight goods, until the Happy New Year looked like a scrambled rainbow and the last caller was sozzled. Toby used to go out every New Year's Day and meet the good-lookers and fuss around with them, for those were his salad days. He made it a combination salad and philandered with about seven before he took the big risk and bought a home with a mortgage attachment and settled down. Then, the Happy New Year began to have an entirely new meaning. He drew a red mark around January 1st, for that was the day when he had to make the books balance and take up some big note that was hanging over him like a storm cloud. His usual plan for celebrating the Happy New Year was to sit in his office figuring on how to trim the payroll and sneak up selling prices and to keep out of the sheriff's office and hands for another 12 months. But the time came when Tobias could take out a pencil on December 31st and compute a net profit big enough to fill a furniture van. To all intents and purposes, he had come to the high ground where he could afford to sit down for a while and enjoy the scenery. He certainly possessed all the accessories of a Happy New Year. He had a bankroll, a house on the boulevard, and a wife who was slowly but surely worming her way into society. He had a son attending a high-priced university and gradually accumulating an Oxford accent, while his daughter was at a school which used the French novel as a textbook. So, after all these years of struggling, Tobias knew what it was to have a genuinely happy New Year. For when the children came home for the holiday vacation, the busy Mrs. Tobias gave a big dancing party on New Year's Eve, to say nothing of a couple of luncheons and a formal dinner. At these glittering functions, the family did what it could to keep Tobias in the background. For while he was a corker when it came to doing a fountain pen specialty with a checkbook, he was a frosted turnip when chucked into a suit costing $100 and put down in a Marie Antoinette apartment with a lot of Chaunceys who had been educated in the East. He celebrated the glad New Year by standing around in doorways and looking mournfully at the lightweights who were doing the cotillion and each one of them having the time of his life. He saw his wife hobnobbing with a human pickerel whose only excuse for being on earth was that he looked well in evening clothes. Daughter was dancing with a lovely specimen of the night-blooming bounder, and son was passing cigarettes. And no one was paying any attention to the provider. So he made a quiet retreat to his own room and had a glass of milk sent up and read the market report. And he managed to put in a pleasant evening after all, seeing the old one out and the new one in. The moral of the story, I don't even think we have to say the moral because it's so obvious. But for those of you who are a little opaque tonight, perhaps a little oblique, we might point out that the moral of the story is this. One New Year is just about as happy as another. You remember when Papa used to do that? Anybody would like to request me to sing some more, I would be more than willing to do it. Tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to do this just one night. Just one night we will do this. Two things. I want you to listen carefully now. The only night of the year that we will ever do it. Here, get me some hot coffee first. And I will now light up a Marlboro. Might as well unbelt. We are going to do it tonight. All right? Have you ever noticed that some clowns seem to have the ability to believe that everything really is going to be all right in spite of it all, more than anybody else in the office? I mean, have you ever known guys like this? And have you ever vaguely envied them? Well, the International Unbiased Vague Testing Corporation of Western North America recently took a survey and found that 9 out of 10 of these chumps are Marlboro smokers. Just a coincidence. And maybe it might work with you. I mean, just a cause and effect thing, possibly just a coincidence. I would suggest that you write it down in your calendar, make it a Marlboro in 1960, and maybe they'll nominate you. Wouldn't you like to make a great announcement to the press that you have decided to withdraw your nomination? With the feeling, of course, that if you continued and persisted in allowing your name to be put in nomination, that the whole country would be in turmoil. And since you are making the great sacrifice, the country's going to have to be in turmoil without you. What a fantastic ego. Excuse me while I drink a little of this hot coffee here. Speaking of egos. Yeah, it is hot. Ooh. By George, no, I'm mad. That's the way. Let's see, do we have another general tire? Let's clear the decks here before we do anything else. Another general tire. This one is live, huh? These guys take that log literally. All right. No, it has to be a song. I don't have any copy. Oh, is it only one general? Two? All right, let's play the song then, Ed. And then we'll do it. I'm going to do it tonight. I feel it happening. First of all, we're going to award the brass figlegee with bronze oak leaf palm to the man who can identify who was it who used to say, "You are a raggle-taggle gypsy varmint." One of the great felicitous phrases in American literature. Tell him to dry up, for crying out loud. Raggle-taggle gypsy varmint. Who was it who used to say that? I thought that was a great phrase. And I'll tell you, and after that, I will also relate one of my favorite stories that came out of that particular comic strip. And speaking of comic strips, Ed, please, if you will. That's it. One, two, three. Right. There's no place you can't go through the ice and the snow with your General Tire winter cleats. General Snow Tires give positive traction with immediate stop-and-go action. All right, stop now, Ed. Stop. Now, wouldn't this be a good commercial if I came on? Just me, you know. I can't sing or anything. All of a sudden, out of your radio would come this voice, and it would go... There's no place you can't go through the ice and the snow with your General Tire winter cleats. General Snow Tires give positive traction with immediate stop-and-go action. Through the snow, there's no place you can't go through the ice and the snow with your General Tire winter cleats. General Snow Tires give positive traction with immediate stop-and-go action. Through the beats, General Winter Cleats. Remember, you go in snow, or we pay the toll. General Winter Cleats. I have a natural musical comedy voice. I mean, nobody in musical comedy can sing, you know. I mean, they go, there's no place you can go through the ice and the snow with your General Tire winter cleats. General Snow Tires give positive traction with immediate stop-and-go action. Through the snow you will glide, not a slip or a slide, with your General winter cleats. For safe winter... Shut up! Stop it! Winter cleats. Remember, you go in snow. Oh, it's my chorus. We pay the toll. A General winter cleats. Da-da-bum. I mean, that's as good as Robert Preston ever was. It is, for crying out loud. Speaking of crying, this is WOR AM and FM. New York, and we'll be here until 1 o'clock. And stay tuned, friends, for further atrocities. All right, I'm going to put you on your mettle. Set that back, Ed, just a second. I want to try it. See how astute our people are out there. Listen, I'll tell you what I will do. I will give a very unusual and very personal gift to the first guy who can identify. You know, there are many famous voices in radio that everybody knows. And it's interesting to see how many of people, these voices are the eternal voices that you've always heard. And how often you can't remember their names. It's the great voice, you know, the great voice that comes out. And the name just means nothing. Who is this? Just put one little word on there. Who is this guy? One of the great all-time radio announcers does this spot. Listen to him.
Grand Union Sale on Backed by Bond Quality Steaks.
Who is that? Who is that? He was connected with and has always been connected with some of the great radio programs during the 1930s and the 40s. And, interestingly enough, he is a listener. He is a listener and has been a listener for a long time, both he and his wife. Who is it?
I'll repeat that Grand Union price.
Who is it? Do you know who it is, Ed? Give me that. I'll see if you know who it is. Who's that? Yeah. All right. All right. Okay. Okay. Now stop. Now we'll go on to the next thing. Now, okay. They've had their money's worth. Okay. Now, here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I'm going to do. Stop now. Stop now. Yeah, what's the matter, Ed? Huh? Yeah, I know it. It sounds very much like him. Yeah. It's interesting. They sound very... Yeah, I know it. They're wrong. All right. Okay. All right, now stop. All right, stop now. All right. One guy recognized it. You know why I did that? It's because I have observed over the years that this fellow who is, by the way, and this is not chauvinism, but who is on WOR, sounds exactly like one of the really great announcers who has been around for many, many years. Here's the clue. It is not Andre Baruch. Immediately everybody hangs up. Because he sounds almost exactly like him on this spot, doesn't he? He really does. And Andre is a listener, too, by the way. He has a delightful sense of humor. And that's probably why he's been successful in the business, where if you have a sense of humor, generally you're ground up.
Only 69 cents a pound.
Oh, stop it, will you? I mean, you give these guys an inch and they start shouting, and they'll be shouting their wares till eternity won't have it, you know? So we'll let that cook for a while. And while we're on the subject of cooking, as we often are, let's get a couple more out of the way. Do you want to try another one? All right. All right. Well, while you're putting that one up, I will tell you that we have with us Gogomobile, which is a fine little German car. And if you're making any resolutions about buying a new car during 1960, the chances are that you will very seriously look at many of the excellent small cars that are now being made available on the American market. And I would like to advise you of this, that the number one selling small car in Western Europe today in the mini car class is the Gogomobile, which has turned out in Western Germany, a little town named Dingolfing, which is in the Bavarian area of Germany. It's not in the Bavarian Alps, nor is it in the Black Forest, contrary to what Newsweek magazine said about it. And it is one of the great phenomenons of the post-war automobile industry any place in the world, because the Gogomobile started from scratch and in about 6 or 7 years has become one of the really top automobile manufacturing concerns in the world. They're sold everywhere in the world. And there are over 300 dealers in the United States. It's a magnificently put together little machine, and one of the truly fine examples of automotive design of today. This is the Gogomobile, and the prices of the cars range. And by the way, somebody sent me and says, "Look, Shepard, there is not one that sells for under $1,000. There is currently. Many of you are getting priceless, which are slightly or have priceless, which are a little outdated. There is a card that runs a little less than $1,000, and they go all the way up to $1,500 and thereabouts for a beautiful station wagon. It's a fine piece of equipment, and you should know about it. And all you have to do is drop a card to GOGO, G-O-G-O. Actually, the name is G-O-G-G-O, which is GOGO in German. But it's the GOGO, to make it easier, G-O-G-O-W-O-R, New York. And they'll send you pictures and literature, and that's about it. You'll at least know what the car is. Okay, you ready in there, Ed? All right, fine. Let it go.
Here is James Darrett.
Hey, Angel Face, just in case you think everything was square before rock, I want you to take a listen to this.
Oh.
Believe it or not, that was old Buddy Salminio cutting on the traps. You know, drums with all the trappings. Well, anyway, that was old Buddy Salminio doing what he does in a great new film that he stars in with Susan Conner called The Gene Krupa Story. Gene was about the hippest cat that ever cut on wax, and Sal plays the great Gene. He's just the greatest, that's all. And I think Susan was never better. That's the sound and the pictures of Gene Krupa Story.
The rhythm poured out of his heart and into his hands. Explosive rhythm, shattering drama. He lived in the bright night world where he was king, and the music throbbed round the clock. See Salminio, Susan Conner, and James Darren in Columbia Pictures' The Gene Krupa Story.
Every time I hear this.
Stop it!
It's too loud for me. Every time I hear this, get that announcer there. Just get the announcer. Don't get Minio there. Hi, Minio. Did I ever tell you about the time I did a show once on craft with Minio? That's the story. All right. Set it in there. You realize, of course, that immediately after that fiasco, I had my agent drawn and quartered. There aren't many places in New York where you can get your agent drawn and quartered, but if you look in your yellow book, you'll find it. It's still being done. I've had this terrible ambition, you see. Wouldn't it be great it's silly, you know? We all lead, in so many ways, we lead these little insignificant lives. And the sad part of it is that everybody does, even Gene Krupa. Probably even more particularly Gene Krupa. But the desire that all of us have, of course, is to have somebody come along and pull our life together and put it in 7 reels in color on widescreen so that it achieves some sort of grandeur. This is kind of the knighthood or the canonization of today, is to have MGM or Columbia decide that they're going to do the Charlie Watanabe story. I mean, that's like getting the sword on the shoulder somehow. And it has taken this insignificant, sniveling human life and has made it into something grand and glorious, and that will be played by Sal Mineo. And I can just see it now. Come on, it's me. Oh, this is Jimmy Stewart. And I'm playing the Gene Shepherd story. It's a great picture. And me and June Allison are doing it. June was never better. Yep, so Jimmy Stewart here, and I'm playing the Gene Shepherd story, and so see it next week at your neighborhood theater.
The rhythm poured out of his heart and
they're talking about me now. Go ahead, let it go. Why'd you stop it?
Explosive rhythm, shattering drama. He lived in the bright night world where he was king.
Ah, that's it. Stop it. Don't, because then they mention Krupa. You know, Krupa, get in on this act. I mean, you live my life, and I'll live yours, Krupa, but that's all right. That's because we're Americans, and we got this togetherness bit. But in the end, I am me, and you are you. Don't push, you know? Now, we will do it. Just once a year. Once a year, I do this, and it has been a custom with me now for over 10 minutes to do this, and it's kind of a tradition. I mean, you know, American traditions now go back sometimes as long as a year and a half, and that's a long tradition. I remember getting a letter from a guy in town here who sells clothing. And I got it about July, something like that. It was back in the summertime. And the reason it was... I thought at the time it was so hot, and the offices are not air-conditioned here. that is, at least the galley slaves' offices are not air-conditioned. And I got this letter, and it said, the Watanabe Clothing and Haberdashery Establishment, established in late 1957. It said above it, long-established history. And so I began to realize, of course, I mean, I'm establishing my own traditions. And now for the at least 10 minutes, I've had this yearly tradition that says that every year I will quietly sit here in this leather chair in this sealed-in cork studio, and I will allow the voice of the vast, faceless, many-celled insect eye of humanity be heard. What is this? I mean, is this that over the past year there must have been some things that were done on the show that were said, or stories that were told, that particularly struck a responsive chord in you. And I'll do this: that if you want to call in and suggest stories that I told in the past year, or things that we did that you particularly liked, we will pick about a half a dozen of them, and before 1 o'clock, maybe as many as we can do, before 1 o'clock tonight. In other words, this is an all-request night. So, start calling them in, anything that you happen to remember, and we will get the list here, and we will see if I can remember. That's the trouble. This show is strictly winged. I wing it. It's like skinning a cat. Or was the cat skun? Or was it skinned? I doubt whether you've ever even heard this word here in the East. Skun. That's a good word in the Midwest, isn't it, Ed? Skun? Sure. I mean, the cat was skun 7 different ways. You know what I mean? He went down to the pool room and got skun again. I mean, they just took it right out of him. That's all. They just sent him right up against that side cushion. They had him, and they had him, and had him again. He came home skun. That's a Midwesternism. Write him down. Just write him down there, and we'll get ready to do it. And I will, for my own enjoyment, such as it is, which is very small, I will now sing one chorus of Asleep in the Deep. Many brave hearts are asleep in the deep. Many brave hearts are asleep in the deep. I've forgotten the words. So sailor beware, sailor take care, many brave. I'm doing this only because I'm indulging myself. I used it when I was about 15 years old, and I had a corrugated voice. I told you one time when I was singing in the Glee Club, you will never guess, I was singing, I don't know why they call Glee Clubs gleeful, because generally they're rather glumful. They have that look and that feel, it's kind of a, and I was in this Glee Club, and I started out by singing soprano at about the age of 8. By the time I was 11, I was singing alto. By the time I was 12, I was singing bass, that is a fact. And by the time I was 13, I was out there at second base for the Hessel, Indiana Eagles. Yes, and at one PTA, now I'm going to tell you, this is a fact, there was this fat, round kindergarten teacher named Miss Bundy, and she wore a flowered print dress, and as a matter of fact, was probably laid away in a flowered print dress. She was one of those women who had flower print dresses probably tattooed on her hide. Fat, you know the kind? And she used to sit there and play the piano, and she was the kind who sounded like she learned to play the piano through one of these correspondence courses. Another kind that always used to say, and now, ladies and gentlemen, you too can learn to play the piano in just 7 days with the new magic 7-color slide rule device that makes it so simple you don't even have to know how to read music. Now listen carefully. Bum pa dum pa bum, ra ta ta tum pa bum, rum pa tum pa tum, ra ta ta tum pa bum. And then with just a few days, you will be adding your left hand, rum pa tum pa bum pa bum, rum pa tum pa bum pa bum, ra pa pa bum pa bum pa bum. That kind of piano, see? So Miss Bundy is playing that kind of piano, and I am singing, get this, at the age of 12. Many brave hearts are asleep in the deep.
Yahoo!
Sailor beware, sailor take care.
are asleep in the deep.
Oh, it's just magnificent. And I of course, recognizing that Miss Bundy was not doing well on the low notes, I always used to fake it in the end, and I'd kind of give her these big cow eyes, and it never failed to break up the audience in the PTA, of course. And Mr. Melton would follow with a flute solo. He would play Poinciana, and he would play Chira Chira Bim on the flute. And that would round up the Wednesday afternoon PTA meeting. And so you see the deep, deep, deep heart of America. Yes, oh America, oh billboarded, gasoline-soaked America, an eagle dies at dawn on 14th Street. Oh, America, I speak to you of love. I speak to you of love, and I speak to you of the tinfoil-covered candy bar that weighs 1/4 pound and contains vitamin B12. I speak to you of love, oh America. The eagle dies at dawn on 14th Street, and where are you? Alan Shepard, beat poet, who speaks of love. So come, baby, sit upon my knee, and we will look out over those long, waving fields of grain, and be part of the great oneness of it all. Come. Why, of course, that's just a matter of personal perspective. As I swing from one vine to the next, as I swing between those trees, those overhanging, overpowering, weeping willows of experience. Of experience, as I swing from tree to tree on this poor little threaded vine of life, I know that in the eventuality it shall always be thus. So spake Zarathustra. Okay. Well, look, as far as that goes, I mean, I'll tell you what it was. Somebody called in and said, what about this thing that happened to your mother that time? This is the first request that came in. Well, look, this is a fact. You know, kids... You know, these are not bits, I want to point out, any more than pieces out of Marcel Proust's Swan's Way are bits. But I will say that brought back a thing to me, which... One of the terrible things of a child's life is the realization that something is wrongly and terribly and badly amiss, and that adults weep. This is a terrible thing. And I remember the first time I ever saw my mother weeping. I come home from school, see, and the radio's up there on the refrigerator. We had this night radio. Do you remember night radios? Allied radios? They had special breakable cabinets that were made out of a special plastic that broke immediately upon contact. Actually, they broke if you looked at them hard, because it was a big business in replacement cabinets, apparently. And we had this radio that was all taped together. There were tubes and chassis sticking out of the back and wires ran, you know, down. And my father was always hooking we had an indoor antenna in this thing that could pick up maybe a radio station at about a 40-foot distance away from it. And so he had pulled the back of it out, and the aerial was sticking out in back of the refrigerator, and he had hooked the end of it down to the hot air register in the mistaken belief that he was getting an antenna. Actually, what he was getting was a high static level, which somehow went very well with Mary Marlin. And I came home one day, see, from school, and I'm just a kid, you know, and you never see, your parents don't cry, you know, it's a terrible thing. You think back. Don't laugh. Think back the first time you ever saw an adult cry. And don't be funny about it. Think about it. It was a terrible moment. And I remember I came home from school, this is when it happened, and I was about in fourth grade or something, fifth grade maybe. And I came home, I was just, you know, big enough, you know, I was a kid, you know. I was a real kid. And I came home, and Mary Marlin was playing on the radio. And they came out with this theme song all the time. Bung, bung, bung. 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 Mouser would say, it's time for Mary Marlin, who at the age of 32 proves that life holds nothing for anybody, and who any minute now, except for the sunshine of the eternal dreaming of Mary Marlin, we'll all go down the drain. Brought to you by the fantastic new Wash Day Miracle, Powy. Bung, bung, bung. Bung, bung, bung. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm sitting at the kitchen table. I just got in, and I'm knocking together a salami sandwich. And this is going on. I hear these people talking, and I hear this man saying something. I never listen to soap operas, but my mother is over there by the sink. And it was this funny thing. I looked up from the sandwich. I had made a salami sandwich. I used to love salami sandwiches on white bread with grape jelly. Have you ever had kosher salami? I mean, real hairy kosher salami. You know, the kind of salami that's alive. It's got little feet on it. And I had this big, thick kosher salami, and I had grape jelly and butter on the white bread. See, and I'm knocking it down there. It was a very, very exotic combination. And, you know, it was very exotic. And if my mother really knew what it did to me, she would never have let me eat it. That terrible stuff. And so I'm putting it down there, and I look up, and my mother is standing there wearing this chenille bathrobe she wore. It was a rump-sprung chenille bathrobe that had a big flowered pattern on it. It was kind of frizzled down around the bottom there, and there were bits of scrambled egg on the lapel. And she's over there by the sink. And Mary Marlin is going on, and I could see there was something wrong. And I look, and I look, and I look, and my mother was crying. She was listening to Mary Marlin and crying. And I said, Ma, what's the matter with you? What? Stop crying, Ma. What are you crying about? Stop crying, Ma. And I'm eating the sandwich, and she turns to me and says, you go in the next room, will you? Go out in the next room, play, do something, be a kid. And she was crying, and I went in the next room, and I went out on the porch, and I stood around, and I fooled around, and the whole rotten, crummy day was just spoiled. Stop crying, Ma. Stop crying, Ma.
Right, okay, okay. We are now back. And I am fascinated by what people are requesting. You know, the thing that I have learned from this this 20-minute tradition we have established. Let's do this every year, then. I think it's a good idea. In case you have just tuned in, what happened or transpired about 30 minutes ago was that since this is the last show of 1959, and we all agree with George Ade that one New Year's is about as happy as the next, that there's no real going forward nor going backward, there's just sort of wallowing is really what we do, kind of tread water. And most of us are ahead of the game if we do and are able to keep our head up above the water. I mean, you don't expect to get up on high ground, do you? You don't expect to pull up there to the high ground so that you can sit down, as Ade said, and enjoy the scenery for a while. Don't be a fool. You are living in a paradise that is pure Walt Disney. It's like that startling bit of information. They took a survey of all the high school children in America, get this here, about 3 or 4 months ago, and they said if you could pick any place in the world if you were given the choice of any place in the world to go to visit, where would you want to go? What do you think they pick? I mean, any place in the world. In other words, the kid could have picked Paris, he could have picked Pakistan, he could have picked Timbuktu, he could have picked any place in the world, the mountains or the moon. And what do you think the poor idiotic school child of America picked? Disneyland. Oh, Disneyland. Oh, Disneyland. La-da-da-dee, my Disneyland. I wonder if Disneyland has a national anthem and a national tradition. I mean, actually, it's a land. I mean, it's just to face it, it's not us. It's not our world. It's Disneyland. Oh, my Disneyland, I salute thee, oh, my Disneyland. With the stars overhead and the flashes of the guns in the night and Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse standing on the ramparts. Oh, Disneyland, I doff my cap to thee, oh, Disneyland. And all these poor little fools pick Disneyland. Now, any of you people, I know every time I talk about children's books, I always get somebody mad by saying that the trouble with most kids' books today is that they don't have any imagination involved for the child's imagination to play with. There's a lot of imaginative work put in on these books, and imaginative illustrations, true, nice bindings. But about the only guy I can see around who is playing with the imagination is Dr. Seuss, who allows the kid to run free and roam. But I feel strongly that this is one of the reasons why kids pick Disneyland of all places to visit. Oh, Disneyland. Anyway, what happened about 20 minutes ago was that since this is the last show, I'll tell you, first of all, don't try it if you're not used to it. It is a very difficult thing. It took me, myself, 15 years to thump a good head. I'm not kidding you. This was part of Look Charlie, too. I am not joshing with you. I truly do thump on my head. I am not hitting the table. I am not thumping on the microphone. I am thumping on my head. And as I said, 15 years of work has produced a fine... And of course, I will admit that I was blessed physically with a very fine head. It has a nice B-flat resonant sound. It's a B-flat head, by the way, which are very rare. The average person has... what we call the C melody head, which is not it's really not as stable as a B-flat head, which has a deeper and richer sound and is far more difficult to play, actually, though, in the end. So I was blessed, and at about the age of 12 or 13, when I began to see that I did have a true talent, I began to take serious lessons, began to work, and I began to also take care of my head. And ever since that time, you might see me off and on, occasionally on the streets, and you'll notice I'm wearing a small beret. This beret is sheepskin lined and is always kept soaked with fine grade neat's foot oil, which keeps my head in good condition. It keeps it soft and pliable. Because if you let your head go too long without a treatment, it develops millions of tiny cracks and a soft, mushy sound, which a professional cannot afford to have. So, listen carefully. I will... Come on, get it right up there, Jerry. Don't be bashful. Okay, now just keep the gain open, Jerry, and I won't make any loud noises. Go. All right. Can I have that opening again, Jerry? Woo! Boy, oh boy. Wow. I feel like Harold Teen after a good, fast workout down at the Sugar Bowl. Woo! I'm definitely not in condition. Definitely. Just the opening. This is a beautiful opening, and I might say this is one of the most difficult passages in all the musicology of head thump. Notice the delicate grace, and there is a sense of innate honesty and certainly an overlaying patina or patina of deeply felt humor, as well as the infinite sadness of a man who is aware of his own mortality. This, by the way, was written by the late Deems Taylor in one of his... do you want to hear the opening now? Just hold it there, and I'll give you the cue. Okay, Jerry. There you go. Yeah, it's the first time you've worked this, isn't it, Jerry? First time you've ever seen me... No, you've seen me head thump, haven't you? Of course. You've seen me down in sales meeting, haven't you? I mean, you've seen me at sales meetings head thumping. We begin to have our visions very early. And oftentimes we misinterpret our visions. We see them not for what they are. And we carry away the wrong things. And many times, even though we think we are carrying away the wrong thing, in reality, we are carrying away the right thing. It's like this kid I knew named Kashmir. I mean, I never really thought about it, but that's a beautiful name, Kashmir. Kashmir Wisnowski. Kashmir lived in this house, and we lived in an apartment, and a very nice apartment. You know, the kind with the elevator that goes up, and a guy who comes and takes the garbage away from the back porch, and, you know, a place. And I remember every day after school, I would go to Kashmir's house. And Kashmir's mother, it was such a wonderful place. The reason it was such a wonderful place was because it was just filled with millions of things. Kashmir's family was a scavenging family. You know, many people who came from Europe years ago retain one of the European habits, particularly a European habit of the peasantry. And that's the habit of saving everything that can possibly be moved, because sometime it might be worth something and might be valuable. You might be able to use it. Maybe you have to burn it sometime when the winter closes in. And Kashmir's family was one of those families, and I didn't recognize it. All I knew was that their house was filled with millions of things. We would go down in the basement, and it would be piles of old tires and pitchforks and watch cases and things like boxes full of old screws and tin cans and things that Kashmir had picked up in alleys and his mother had picked up on the way home from the factory. She was a rummager in waste baskets, that kind of thing. And their house was filled with this stuff. And she used to make this bread, I remember. She was the only woman I ever knew. My mother was strictly a Wonder Bread type, you know? The kind of bread you could squeeze. And it was always being advertised on the radio with the Lone Ranger. And Wonder Bread and Silver Cup Bread. And this is the kind of world we lived in. But Kashmir's mother made bread. And she used to have it out on the kitchen table, a great big pile of this stuff. And it was bread dough. And I used to watch her. She had big hands, and she's kneading this stuff. And the bread would come out of the oven, and it would be sort of gray and rough and hard and knobbly. But it seemed great to me, only because, of course, it was different. And Kashmir's family, and I didn't know it at the time, was so poor that they were the only people I ever knew who ate cold spaghetti sandwiches. Have you ever eaten a cold spaghetti sandwich? Well, they would have spaghetti from last week. And Kashmir would bring cold spaghetti sandwiches to school with ketchup on them. And I used to think, gee, Ma, why can't I have cold spaghetti sandwiches? My mother says, cold spaghetti sandwiches. What are you talking about? I used to say, well, Kashmir has cold spaghetti sandwiches. And my mom never said anything about it. But I used to think that was wonderful. And they used to make, I remember they used to have once in a while a mixing bowl. It was a funny thing. I lived in a family that used to buy the higher price spread, which we know of today as the higher price spread. Ed, do you remember when there was sort of an unconscious, below the surface stigma that attached to anyone who used margarine? Yes. And I remember that I used to go over to Kashmir's house, and his mother would have a big bowl of this stuff that looked like lard. It didn't come colored then, you know. And it had little pills like, or little papers that you would open up, and it had orange powder, and you'd mix it up, and it would be streaked. And they'd mix this all up, and I remember one time I came home from his house, and I had a piece of this gray bread, and it was smeared all over with this streaked orange stuff, and I thought it was great. And my mother says, throw that away. That's terrible. Throw that away. I said, well, what is it? Mrs. Kashmir Wisnowski, Mrs. Wisnowski gave this to me. My mother said, you just throw it away and I'll give you a piece of bread with some jelly on it and some butter. And I remember I used to love to go over there. And one of the things that we used to do at nighttime when I would be over there after school, it would be about 8 o'clock. This was before television, when kids used to do things like this. Their kitchen was always loaded with old dirty dishes. And there were big cracks in the linoleum on the floor. And it was a kitchen that kind of smelled like caked grease. You know how old caked grease smells? Well, that was the way their kitchen smelled. And I didn't know it, of course, but it was a filthy, dirty kitchen But it was just a great kitchen to me because Cashmere and I would come in the dark and we would hide in the kitchen and then we would throw on the electric light switch and millions, and I mean millions of cockroaches, would run from all direction and would run into the clock. They had a clock hanging on the wall. And the cockroaches would run into this clock. And so Cashmere and I would stand there and we would catch all the cockroaches, as many as we could catch, and put them in a bottle. I didn't know what cockroaches were. And I thought they were great. And I used to go home and ask my mother, why don't we have these things, these bugs that they have over there that are so great? And she used to just sort of say, now, come on. You go to bed now. Don't talk like that. And we used to catch the cockroaches, and we used to keep them in great big jars down in the basement. And it was one of the big sports that I looked forward to. And then one day came, it was, well, maybe I was in, I guess I was about a sophomore in high school. It's a funny thing, you know. Kids develop conscience at a very peculiar time. They're very shaky. Kids are like Jell-O, and they quiver. And they're shaky, and they've got little grapes floating around in them, and canned pineapple and stuff. And they kind of waver with the wind, and they melt. And this is the whole experience of being an adolescent, is like being half-formed Jell-O. And so here I am shaking around, and suddenly, it hit me. Cashmere Wisnowski and his whole family were very, very poor people. They were poor. And I didn't know this up until this point. It just seemed like they lived a great life, and they were poor. And I mean really poor. I mean, they ate spaghetti sandwiches. And I remember going home, and I said to my mother, this is a clear remembrance, and I said, Ma, how come some people are poor? And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, why is it some people are poor? She says, well, what do you mean poor? I says, well, you know, like, and I couldn't get myself to say Cashmere because he had been my friend for years, and suddenly it was like he had some terrible disease, some awful disease that I couldn't say anything about. I said, well, you know how some people are real poor, you know, like kids come to school and they wear these corduroy knickers. And Cashmere always wore corduroy knickers, even when he was in high school. And all the rest of us were wearing slacks. And she says, well, that's pretty hard to say why some people are poor. But there are always some poor people, that's all. My mother said, there are always poor people. There have always been poor people, and I guess there always will be. And I couldn't understand that. Why are some people poor and some are not poor? And the poor people seemed to be pretty much like everybody else, except they were poor. They had the bugs in the clock. And they had spaghetti sandwiches. And they had inner tubes and tires down in the basement. I couldn't figure this out. And from that day on, this is true. I could never walk around or be with or even hardly talk to Cashmere. It's just impossible. I couldn't do it. And I used to feel funny about it. I used to try to say, well, now look, you know, but it couldn't work. And I never went back, ever. I never had any of that gray bread anymore. I never went back to it, ever again. It's like you suddenly find out. Now hold it down, Ed. Keep it in a bath in abeyance now. Set it back for Q. Set it back for Q. It's cruel cold on the waterfront. Silent, dark and drear. Only the black tide weltering in the hissing snow. And I alone, like a storm-tossed wreck on this night of the glad new year, shuffling along in the icy wind, ghastly, gaunt, and slow. Oh, I hear it. They're playing a tune in McGuffey's Saloon, and it's cheery and bright in there. God,
It's the bitter dawn and not a bite of food. I'll just go over and slip inside. I mustn't give way to despair. Perhaps I can bum a little booze if the boys are feeling good. They'll jeer at me and they'll sneer at me and they'll call me a whiskey soak. Have a drink. Oh, thank you kindly, sir. I don't mind if I do. A dribbling, dirty, gin-joint fiend, the butt of a barroom joke, sunk and sodden and hopeless. Another? Well, here's to you. McGuffey is showing a bunch of the boys how Bob Fitzsimmons hit. The barman is talking of Tammany Hall and why the ward boss got fired. I'll just sneak into a corner and they'll let me alone a bit. The room is reeling round and round. God, I'm tired. I'm so tired. Roses she wore on her breast that night. Oh, but their scent was sweet. Alone, we sat on the balcony and the fan palms arched above. The witching strain of a waltz by Strauss came up to our little cool retreat. And I prisoned her little hand in mine and I whispered my plea of love. And then suddenly the laughter died on her lips and slowly she bent her head. And there came in the deep, dark eyes a look that was heaven to see. And the moments went, and I waited there. Never a word was said, and then she plucked from her bosom a rose of red and shyly gave it to me. And then the music swelled to a crash of joy, and the lights blazed up like day. And I held her fast to my throbbing heart, and I kissed her bonny brow. She is mine. She is mine forevermore. The music seemed to say, and the bells were ringing in the new year. God, I can hear them now. Don't you remember that long last waltz with its sobbing, sad refrain? Don't you remember that last goodbye and the dear eyes dim with tears? Don't you remember that golden dream with never a hint of pain, of lives that would blend like an angel's song in the bliss of the coming years? What have I lost? What have I lost? Ethel, forgive. The red rose has faded now, and it's 50 years ago. It were better I'd died 1,000 deaths that live each day as I live. I have sinned. I have sunk to the lowest depths. But I have suffered so. I can hear the bells. Look, I can see her there. She's just like a dream. I can hear the bells of the crowded court. See the judge. He looks down. Not guilty. I'm not guilty. I can hear the bells. Get up, old man. It's 12 o'clock. You can't sleep here. Come on. Ain't you got no sentiment? Have a drink to the glad new year. Come on, buddy. Have a drink, a drop before you go, you miserable old hobo. My God, boys, he's dead. He is dead. Fantastic. That's Robert Service's New Year. And together we will sing When the Swallows Return from Capistrano. Together, you and I, eternally mired in the sea of sticky mediocrity. Come, come, Esther Jane. Will you go to the prom with me, my dear, again? Will you go? Will you come? You are having my only invitation engraved. The only one I ever sent in my life. The only one. Somebody says Shepard scat sing with Duke Ellington. You know who that somebody was? Me. Ba 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 ba
Shepard, you are a gasser.
You know, I want to say this. May I make a personal remark before we go any further? And I have never done this. As you probably are aware, this show has had a stormy career. And don't ever accuse Shepard of getting commercial, because if Shepard was commercial, he would be on late-night television all night with Elsa Maxwell sitting on one side and Jean-Vieve on the other. He ain't. As you obviously see, he ain't. And if you look back over what is called commercial in this business, generally it is what appeals to the most number of people at the greatest amount of time and sells the most jazz. Unfortunately, this program has never done any of those things. And all I can say is this, something I haven't said ever. About 4 years ago, many of you listeners remember the big incident of the show being taken off the air when I was on late night. I used to be on seven nights a week. And the listeners wrote in and got us back. This was, none of this stuff was hooked up. There was no publicity involved. There was a lot of stuff that went on behind the scenes that someday will make a very interesting story. But I can say this, without the listeners who did what they did, I would never be working in New York today. It's a fortunate or an unfortunate fact, whichever way you happen to look at it. And I can only say this. This is a personal remark. I must thank people who have listened to me for years, because it is quite obvious that quite often it must be difficult to listen to me. Many times I obviously get very boring. This is a fact. Writers get boring for many pages, but you can skip the pages, you know? Hemingway bores me many times, but he also exalts many times. And I recognize that I must be very boring, and I must oftentimes be lying fallow when I shouldn't be, because what I do is difficult in one sense. That a writer, you know, when he has a bad day, just stops writing for a while. You never see that part of him. You don't read the stuff he throws away, or that his editors knock out. You only read that which is finally culled, and the danger of what I do, obviously, is that you hear the good and you hear the bad. There's no way for me to say, forget that last half hour, that was awful. Well, it's a fact, and I know that there are many half hours that are awful, and I'm the first to admit it. But I hope that in some small way there are moments that are good. I have enough ego to believe that there are. And to the people who have stuck over the years and who listen, I can only thank you, because I am very selfish about what I do. I do it because it's important and necessary for me to do it. I'm not one of these performers who will get out and say, thank you one and all for being such a wonderful audience. No, this is not what I'm doing. I'm thanking you for sticking with the bad moments and the bad periods, which obviously I have many of. In short, I'm very, very grateful, that's all. And I hope that in the next year or so, I will be able to enlarge my scope. And don't think that if I go on the stage with my material, which is in the offing, I'm scheduled to open in New Faces this spring, that it will be any different. I go because I have been around too long to do something merely because I have been given the opportunity to do it. I will only do it if it is being done the way I must say what I have to say. And this is, again, not the statement of a braggadocio. It's a statement of fact. Because somewhere along the line, I have discovered that men live and die. And they live and die regardless of whether they have been on the Jack Parr show or not. They live and die. And they don't die any happier either, under one condition or under another. Now, death is never funny. And it never comes, incidentally, it never comes too soon, nor does it ever come too late. You know, people always say about a death, they say, you know, he's better off. Nobody is ever better off. I refuse to accept it. Speaking of death, this is WOR, AM and FM. I couldn't resist it. I feel that if maybe I was 19 years old, I would not feel the way I feel. I would have learned to do my tap dance well, and I would learn my jazzy jokes, and I would have made the nightclub circuit, which is the easiest circuit, by the way, to make. Having worked in clubs, I can say that most of the guys I've known have material bits which they... If you were to say to the average one, do all your stuff, you would have heard him all in 25 minutes, or maybe 40 at the most. He has said his all. And I could have done this, but that's another story. And in exchange for the decisions that I have made, I must say that I feel very grateful for the people who have stuck. Because it's so easy to fall into a routine, and when a person does, this is safe. It's easy to fall into a series of things which he knows will get laughs. For example, if I were to do the show that most people seem to think they want me to do, I would begin, I would read Fu Manchu. Then I would hurl an invective. Then I would tell the story about the starlings. Then I would tell the story about Miss Shields. Then I would hurl another invective. Then I would read the face on the barroom floor. And apparently I would do this show every week. And by the end of the third week, you would be back there watching Loretta Young. I can tell you this. And I would have slowly died and would be out somewhere, someplace, telling jokes in a nightclub. I'm not about to do this. But this is a personal policy statement here, and I hope you accept it as that. But I must say thank you for sticking around when I have been terrible. I will not thank you for listening when I've been good. That's been your fortune. I will be that much of an ego because it hasn't cost you a red cent. But I will thank you for sticking around through the mires and the muck, which must come awful fast sometimes, which I know do. Sometimes after I finish the show, I am so low I am so deep in depression that I can hardly look up to the top of the building where the big sign says, if you never see another movie in your life, you must see this one. I don't even see that sign. And these are facts, and I can say thank you, you know, for sticking when the going has been sticky. It has been. And speaking of sticky going, we have with us Worth Perfume, our final sponsor for tonight. And by the way, this is another thing I want to say, that no radio program, and in fact, anything today, I don't care whether your name is Faulkner or not, you would never hear of Faulkner unless he sold books. This is an unfortunate fact of the matter, my dear. If you want an interesting experience, just take your favorite novel and open it up and look inside the flyleaf, and you will see it says $3.95. Somebody is getting that dough. And I can say that there is nothing today that comes to you cheaper than that which you get out of your radio. This is a fact. And generally, it is cheap, too, for that reason. An unfortunate fact, too. But I am most grateful, not only to the people who have listened to the program, and you will never hear me say this again, so listen. I am most grateful to the people who have been brave enough and courageous enough to sponsor the show. Now, I say courageous not in the sense of me doing a controversial show, in the sense that it is quite obvious I ain't going to sell a lot of goods. That in itself is controversial in our business. And people like Marlboro Cigarettes, people like Gogo Mobile, and I know that oftentimes in a four-hour show you say, why does this guy have to do a commercial? Well, my dear, it's because if I didn't, there would be no show at all. And you could sit out there on your duff and listen to Joni James records. And I might point out another salient fact. I don't think Geraldine Page works for nothing. I think when you walk through that box office, you plunk down some good hard coin. And hardly anybody ever goes through that box office and says, I don't know why I have to pay for this stuff. This is art. Art my foot. You pay for it, and you pay hard and hard for it. And when you go into the Museum of Modern Art, they have a box office that you pay for when you walk through there. It is an unfortunate fact of our world. And these poor little one-minute commercials that come through about every 45 minutes on the show seem to irritate people more than the $42 they'll plunk down for a 10th-rate musical, of which there is hardly any other kind these days. And yet, it is one of the strange and salient facts of our world. And I'm just, in by way of this, I don't send out Christmas cards. I haven't sent any Christmas cards to the people at Worth. And I haven't sent any Christmas cards to the Paper Book Gallery. I haven't sent any Christmas cards to Marlboro Books. They haven't sent any to me either. And the only thing that they have done, which is the most important thing, for all of us, I mean, I assume a few of you listen, and I do it, is that they have picked up the charge of admission through the whole year, and I am very grateful to them for that. And one of those people is Worth Perfume. If you're thinking of investing in any perfume, I would suggest you look up Worth. You will find them in all the best perfume counters in most of the better stores. Worth Perfume, that's all I'll say about sponsors tonight. This is a strange and an odd business, and you know, it's like momentarily you're influenced, you're constantly being influenced. There are constantly images coming up before you, which are there, you see, whether or not you look at them, and which, once having impressed themselves upon you, burn themselves deeply, deeply into your total personality, your total being, so that there, in the end, is no escape at all. Like there is nothing really that has ever really truly has been as deep an influence upon me as the Orpheum Theater in Hammond, Indiana. The Orpheum Theater, like all theaters that I've ever known, had a vaguely mingled smell of old carpets and petrified gum, and celluloid, maybe, and thousands of yesterday's bodies, all of them mingled in there together, and a strangely electrical overtone. I don't know why there is the smell of electricity in old movie houses, but there is. Maybe it's the machinery. Maybe it's the lights that say exit on them. And so I'm sitting down there, you know,
little realizing that I am about to get one of the great scenes of my life. It was in this movie, which I still firmly believe was a movie that I created in my own mind. The Bitter Tea of General Yen. I remember my mother, you know, my mother standing over there by the sink, and I had seen this movie, and it was a great movie, and it moved me, you know. Kids, for the first time, you know, when you're really moved by something other than a candy bar or Christmas or something coming, when you're first moved, well, this movie so moved me. So, what's the trouble in there? This movie so moved me that for the very first time in my life, I felt an emotion that had nothing to do with eating or other physical problems. And I remember coming home and I said, Ma, it's the Bitter Tea of General Yen. And I remember my mother saying, oh, so you went to see the Bitter Yen of General Tea, huh? I'd say, no, Ma, don't talk like that. It was the Bitter Tea of General Yen. The Bitter Yen? No, the Bitter Tea of General... The Bitter Yen? It was the Bitter Tea of General Yen, Ma. And you shouldn't be funny about it, because it was a very serious picture, and you just don't understand. And she used to always laugh, and you know, to this very day, when I see my mother, she always brings it up. She says, have you seen the Bitter Yen of General Tea lately? Boy, I'm telling you, mothers are ridiculous. And she says, but she says a lot of things, too. One of them is this, I am not long for this world, and when are you going to get a job? Those three things in that order. Why don't you work once? Do it like your brother. He works. I'd say, yeah, Ma, he works, but I, you know, I'm work. What do you think I'm doing? She says, oh, you're just talking. You're writing that stuff down and drawing all those pictures. Why don't you work? I could see Pablo Picasso with his mother saying, will you quit fooling around with the Crayolas? Why don't you get a job? Why don't you go out there and do something like the rest of the crowd? And so I'm sitting there, and this was the scene. I'll never forget it. There was this guy who was this general. And all the other generals and all the other officers had questioned his ability to be an officer. I guess. It was a very murky film, and filmed, obviously, in very cheap celluloid because it was hard to see. But it was in China someplace. And I think it was somebody like Chester Morris, made up to look like a Chinaman. Or maybe it was Bruce Cabot or somebody like that. But anyway, I know his eyes were kind of puffy. And his name was General Yen. Jeez, you know, I just say this, and I feel shaking, quivery inside. But old General Yen, I mean, because it had a profound effect on me, actually. I'm not being funny when I say this. It truly did. And General Yen, it was dawn, and he had his whole battalion lined up, and all the other officers were out there, and they were wearing their puttees, and they were all standing there at attention, and it was a matter of honor. And you know, I guess this is what the great importance was. I had never encountered honor before. Honor was very, very, it wasn't even a rumor on the south side of Chicago. There was this thing of the scout oath, which I can almost remember. What does it say? Well, reverent, brave, clean, reverent, brave, clean, honest, reliable, sober, industrious. Anyway, I was going to be all those things, but I don't think they ever mentioned honor. And I remember Chester Morris or Bruce Cabot or whoever he was with the puffy eyes looking out at all of us in the Orpheum Theater there, and he is saying something about honor, and I didn't know what this meant. And I remember then the scene was at dawn, and you could see the sun coming up, and oh, it was a terrible thing. And all these men were lined up out there, all of them standing at attention, all these soldiers. And Bruce Cabot looked out at us, and he was supposed to be talking to the other man, the other general, and he said, it is a matter of honor, General. And since it is a matter of honor, there is nothing else I can do. And he turned and he looked at all the men, all of his men. They were all standing at attention, and they were in their uniforms. And he said, men, what I am about to do is a matter of honor. And there was a long silence, and you could hear some crickets and some birds, because it was just dawn. And that was what made it so sad. It was dawn, and it was springtime. And you could see a few of the trees were budding, and all the men were standing at attention. And then his voice was kind of shaky, and it barked out, and he said, attention! Draw sidearms! Draw!
and all the men reached down and they pulled out their 45s, which were strapped to their waist. And then he said, "Right face!" And all the men faced right, which meant that they were, each man was looking at the back of the man to his right. And it was a terrible moment. All the men were standing there with their pistols, and they were all looking off to the right. And then he said, "Raise sidearms! Aim at the man directly in front of you! Ready! Aim!" And it was this long moment, and you could see the little trees were budding, and you could see the sun coming up over this far horizon. And I'm sitting there in the fourth row, and I got this quarter-pound Baby Ruth bar. I have even forgotten to eat it, and it is melting. It's in my left hand, and it's melting down all over my knickers. And I can feel the chocolate oozing down to my elbow, and I can feel the peanuts dribbling down into my cup. But now I feel nothing. I'm sitting there. I mean, I can't say anything. I realize what's about to happen, but I don't want it to happen. It's springtime, and all these men... And then he said, "Fire!" And then the camera backed up, and you could see this long shot, and you heard, boom! And you just saw all the men slowly begin to crumple. And then Bruce Cabot, or Chester Morris, whoever he was, with his puffy eyes turned on his heel, and he marched off the parade ground. And I'm sitting there. I don't know what to do. And all of a sudden, you hear in the distance, from the general's house, you hear the sound of a single shot. Boom! Just like that. A single shot. And I'm sitting there, in the 23rd row, with my Baby Ruth candy bar running down my elbow. And I was never, ever, to, ever, ever, ever again to be the same. I could never go back. I could never go back to stealing copper wire ever again. I could never go back to... I could never go back, and I knew it. It was one of those moments. It was the bitter yen of General T. And each one of us has the bitter yen somewhere. The bitter yen that we can never escape. That deep, bitter gall. Ed, can you give me my blues record? The one that's on tape? We just got to have that. It's like that first view. Oh, there are the indelible, inked in, etched in images that each one of us will carry to our graves. That are inescapable. It's like that first scene, you know? It's a funny thing. Probably one of the great moments. We all live, our lives are actually lived in sequences, more or less, in kind of eras, stretches, periods. You know, this is true, Ed, that our lives are lived in periods. And I don't mean the ancient designation of youth, of childhood, youth, middle age, and old age. I don't mean those periods. I mean we go through a period in our own personal life, and everybody's chapters or passages are of different length and are of different meanings, of course. But there is no one individual who is like another individual at all, because the millions and millions of wires and the skeins that we travel on, the billions of spider webs that we weave, are all of an infinitely varied pattern and nature, so that it is impossible ever to fit one against the other. It's like the million, million thumbprint, that there is no coinciding, never. There never will be. But pretty many of the thumbs look alike, but not the prints. And many of the lives look alike, but they're not. And I remember the first day in the Army, the first night in the Army. This was an important moment, and I knew it. Strangely enough, of course, it was quite obvious that it was. Generally, when we enter a new period in our life, we don't recognize a new period. We don't recognize it until maybe a year, maybe 5 years, maybe never. Until many years later, maybe. Maybe never, really, in the end. But we do, nevertheless, live through these periods. And I knew that this was going to be a period, a chapter, a long stretch in my life. Something that I would never emerge from the same. And funny, during war, when you go off to war, you have all kinds of mingled feelings. One of them is that you're never going to come back. Believe me, a lot of guys feel this. I think almost everybody did. And yet you have the also feeling that you are going to come back and that nothing is going to happen here is ridiculous. Because you can never personalize it, really. And then you also have the feeling of this is a great adventure, and you also have the feeling that somehow you're frightened and you got to run back. Because we are both pulled and repelled by adventure. Because adventure always means some kind of danger. And so I remember I'm on a train and we're going to Camp Crowder. The name Camp Crowder itself probably strikes a kind of ridiculous, just a fantastically comic, mirthful, sad, frightened laughter in a million guys. Just say it again and roll it over your tongue. Camp Crowder. Camp Crowder. And I didn't know, of course. Nobody does. I had no idea where I was going, but I was going to Crowder. And I'm on this train. And I'm sitting there, and it's late at night. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. And it's terribly hot. It's fantastically hot in this car. And it's winter time. And we have just been at war maybe a short time. And I, as a kid, had read about 19 million G8 and his battle aces stories. And the idea of war was very exciting. And I thought to myself, I am in an enemy country to somebody else. And some other guy is wondering how it must be here, and the other guy in that other country that is my enemy country is probably plotting to kill me. All these crazy things were going on through my mind. And all the while, I'm wearing this brand new GI shirt, which is scratching me around the neck. And it had a scratchy tie. It was the first time I ever had seen a tie that was scratchy. And it was a scratchy tie, and I had scratchy pants that were made out of what they used to call in the Army horse blanket pants. And they were horse blanket pants, all right. It was like Sears Roebuck Emery paper on a Saturday night. And I'm sitting in there in this car, and it was such an old car that it had green plush seats with dark red wood around it. And up at the top of the windows, there were stained glass roses, of all things. I had never seen a train like that. And it had gas jets that were not in use, but were just sticking out. And everybody had his packs and junk hung on the gas jets. And I'm sitting in there bolt upright, and we are going south. And we have just left this place, and it's about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I remember this image. I am listening carefully to my own image. This is a very personal dream and a very personal moment. And we crossed, of all things, the Ohio River. We crossed the Ohio River. I don't remember where. I guess it was down around Evansville someplace. And it was on a suspension bridge, I remember. And I had never been more than about 9 feet from home before this time. And it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was winter. And the moon was coming down on this river. And you could just see it stretching out and out, and it was cold and kind of bleak. And you could see the dark forest rising up, you know. The river goes through deep, hilly country there. And I'm sitting next to this guy who was a teacher. I remember It was the only teacher I ever knew in the Army. And he had been a teacher and had been a champion ping pong player. It was an odd thing. I didn't know it at the time. And a great tragedy befell this guy, by the way. He was killed. He was killed in a very sad way. Of course, we knew not this either at the time. He was killed in a very sad way. And I was there when he was killed. And I, of course, again, as I say, this is a funny thing. I've never thought about this till this time. He was killed under a truck. And we were out on a maneuver. And it was a night maneuver. And all of us went to sleep for about 2 hours. And a truck ran over him in the dark. I remember that. But anyway, he was sitting next to me. Both of us in the dark. And it was hot. And our collars were scratching us. And we had no other clothes. And we were just sweating. And I was much younger than he was. And somehow, he felt as though he should father me or something. You know, it was a funny business. I was about 17 or 18, I guess, at the time. And he must have been about a cool 25, which made him absolutely the oldest guy in the whole outfit. He was the old man. And he was appointed corporal, acting corporal in this car, which immediately meant like he was a general. And we were sitting there, and he was awake, and everybody else was asleep. And I was awake. And I'm looking at this river out of the window, and I was on the window side of the seat, and he was sitting next to me. And I looked out at this moon coming down. I said, "Boy, I wonder what river that is." And this guy said to me, he says, "That's the Ohio River, and that's Kentucky over there." Well, to me, this it was kind of the South, and there was something always romantic and warm and soft about the South. But here it was Ohio. It looked just like Indiana. It looked just like Chicago. It looked like everything else. And I'm looking down, and it suddenly hit me right then, that moment. No moment up to that moment had done it. It hit me that I was really going away. I was really going away. And I got a kind of a funny, scared feeling. And he said to me, he says, "You know, everybody's going away." He apparently sensed it. He says, "Everybody's going away, and it doesn't make any difference, you know. Because in the end, everybody really does go away." And I said, "What are you talking about?" You know, I was just a kid. And I says, what are you talking about? He says, "Well, you know, it doesn't really pay to get scared." I says, "Me scared?" Oh, boy. I says, "Look at that tree down there floating on the water." And there was a tree floating along, and we just went right over that long suspension bridge. It was about a mile long, and we headed into the hills of Kentucky, and I fell asleep. And it was hot, and my neck was scratching, and the tie was scratching, and I remember it so well. I remember it so, so very, very well. And there's no escaping them, you know, those images. Those close, dark images that you hold always deep inside of you. You know, we all go away in the end. We all go away. So there's no sense in being scared. It just doesn't do it to you. I mean, or for you. What do you mean scared? Me scared? Huh. Boy, look at that tree down there floating in the moon. Here, and we'll be back in wonderful, beautiful, great, glorious 1960. And remember, Life magazine has an issue called The Good Life. Are you living it? Read this week's issue and find out. Be the first in your neighborhood to admit defeat.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news. Your dial is set for Long John Neville's Party Line. This is WOR, AM and FM, New York, owned and operated by RKO General. At the WOR time tone, exactly 1 a.m.